真对你，或者他在真正的带领过来，真正对你的，我们就要说他，他是对你的，你就莫把他去学习，你去上，你训练，你什么？他真正的带领团队，你也不要谢谢，你莫把我一个，把他一个地方突然间从最艰难的心境的，也是啊，艰难心境上，你就莫把去学，但他这你莫把人家过去别人。
So, good evening, everyone. So, previously we looked up to the, we were looking at the presentation on the Mind Only School. So, we looked at, we came up to the end of the presentation of the Chittamatrans. So we looked at the afflictions that need to be abandoned and the various obscurations that need to be abandoned. And we spoke about the path that one needs to practice and in order to go through the various stages of abandoning the afflictions. And we spoke about how the direct antidote to these afflictions and to the obscurations is the wisdom realizing emptiness. And we also spoke about how, in addition to cultivating this this wisdom that is realizing emptiness, one needs to cultivate merit. And this is done through practices such as generosity, ethical conduct, joyous perseverance, and the cultivation of patience and the like. So practices such as that. So that's what we looked at last time. So tonight we're starting at the top of page 21, looking at the school, the middle way, or the Madhyamaka. And so we're starting there tonight, and we're going to look in particular at the first of the subdivisions of the middle way school, the Svatantika, or the autonomous. Presentation on the middle way school starts by looking, before one actually divides into the two subdivisions, one looks at what is called the proponents of non-nature. So the meaning of non-nature is quite vast. There are really many things that can be said. For example, functioning things, they have no nature. Or previously, when we were looking at the previous presentation, that of the Chittamatrans, we saw how objects are empty of being externally established. So this too is a meaning of no nature. Here, in the context of the Madhyamaka, no nature refers to things lacking true existence. So the meaning of no nature here is the lacking of true existence. And a person who accepts that things lack true existence, that things have no nature, then they are a proponent of the middle way. They are a Madhyamika.
Mm-hmm.
And so these proponents of the of non-nature, or Madhyamaka, as we could say. So the proponents of non-nature, what do they accept? So that is explained in the definition, in the first outline. Then there are divisions within the middle way school, so that is mentioned in the second outline, and then that is explained in some detail in the third outline. So, Andy, if you could bring up our first slide, so slide 28. So this is the definition of a proponent of non-nature. So we have it here in the book, and also on the slide will be the definition of the Svatantika, so what will come in a moment. So so that we have the two definitions there. What you'll see on the screen is slightly different from what we have in the text, and that will be explained. Read it. Okay, so we have the definition here. So a person propounding great ethical tenets, he does not assert truly existent functioning things, even conventionally. So you'll notice we've inserted functioning things, so that's not in the book. So in the discussion with Genla, he says this should be there in the English because it is there in the Tibetan, and it has a specific meaning, so that will be explained in a moment. And then just to say one extra thing from my side, so we see that truly existent functioning things, and then we have below, I think, for the Svatantika, it says truly established. So just to say that whenever you see truly existent or truly established, it's the same word. So existent or established, sometimes the translator chooses one or the other. And so if you see something is established by its own nature or something exists by its own nature, it's the same word. So don't think that there's a difference between existence and establishment, it's the same word. Okay, so let's now to say what Genla said. So the definition he read. So where it says here, truly existent functioning things are not asserted even conventionally. So this is important. So they don't accept true existence or true establishment of functioning things or permanent phenomena. But functioning things is emphasized here. But the meaning is functioning things and permanent phenomena. So you remember functioning things has an equivalent of impermanent phenomena. So it's actually both impermanent and permanent. There are no truly existent phenomena, whether permanent or impermanent. But the impermanent or functioning things is being emphasized here. And then it says not conventionally. So the reason for saying not conventionally is because someone may have this doubt. So, okay, so a middle way proponent doesn't accept truly established functioning things ultimately, but maybe they accept them conventionally. So here it's saying even conventionally or not even conventionally. So a middle way proponent doesn't accept any phenomenon to be truly existent, whether ultimately or conventionally. Neither in either case or neither case are truly existent phenomena asserted. Yes.
서로가 휴기 당했을 때 공부를 이거는 많이 보고 그래서 이게 때리는 남자 신 지금 가사에서 캐치 그거 가사를
So the, to summarize this second part of the definition here, the do not assert truly existent functioning things even conventionally. So this, to put in summary, is that no phenomenon at all is accepted to be truly existent in any circumstance. So not a permanent or impermanent phenomenon, and not conventionally or ultimately, no phenomenon in any circumstance is accepted as being truly existent by a proponent of the middle way. Furthermore, and then what we see at the beginning, a person propounding great the ethical tenets. So this is the same as before, the same meaning as previously when we had this with the Chittamatra definition. So here they propound the selflessness of phenomena, not just the selflessness of persons. So they propound the selflessness of phenomena, and this makes them Mahayana tenets. We have the two truths. So we have conventional truth or concealer truth and ultimate truth. Ultimate truth refers to emptiness, and concealer truth or conventional truth refers to everything other than emptiness. I'm looking amongst all functioning things or impermanent phenomena, if we take the famous vase as an illustration. So there's a vase and we're seeing this vase. So this vase is a vase that's not emptiness. So amongst conventional and ultimate, which is it? It's not an ultimate truth because the vase isn't an ultimate truth. So it's not an ultimate object. And it's not something that is realized by a yogic direct valid cognizer. However, there is still a vase before us, so it's not emptiness, it's not an ultimate truth, it's not realized by a yogic direct valid cognizer, but there is a vase. So that vase is a conventionality. So it exists, it's a conventionality, it's not an ultimate truth, and what makes it a conventionality is it's realized by a conventional direct valid cognizer. So it's a conventional truth or a concealer truth, and it's realized by a valid cognizer.
이 난다 대머리도 공부할 때 이 공부할 때 저런 걸 여러분들 여러분 이제 태이 되어가서 공부하고 공부하다 수업까지네. 아니네 나는 대머리도 수업해 대머리도 공부할 때 대머리도 공부 아니 대머리도 공부 대머리도 수업한다. 아니 계속 나 태이 되어야 돼. 네 나는 저런 걸 여러분 자기 말 돈이 많아. 이제 혼자 태이 되어야 되나 지금도 와 태이 되어야 말았어. 这个我的真正的来说的话，他就说，真的把他，你就别那啊，或者说男主角把你那参与这个来着，对吧？过参与这个来着，那他，那男主角呢，那个那个，全部都是拥抱的，全部都是给，那个我，全部都是舒服的，你也全部都是拥抱的，舒服的呢，怎么样？他们参与这个呢，越舒服的话，就，我就说，参与这个来着，那过真男朋友嘛，没有办法，参与这个来着，你那全部都把马老师也。 but then any day I go for this, right? And you do younger, to be younger, and now that, then I'm the male of my day, and you do it, you get it.
So we're staying with that definition and this explanation of that they don't accept, the middle way proponents don't accept truly existent functioning things. So we have our vase here, and we've seen that this vase, it's not emptiness, so therefore it's not an ultimate truth, but the vase still exists, and so this vase is an object of a conventional. Valid cognizer, so it's realized by conventional valid cognizer, so therefore it is a concealer truth. So now, if someone then has a doubt and they say, so this vase, you're saying it's not an ultimate truth, so it cannot therefore be a truly existent ultimate truth, we understand that, but do you accept that this vase is, that it is a concealer, that is a concealer truth, or conventionality, this vase that is a conventionality, do you accept that it, as a conventionality, is truly existent? And the person who would be asking this would be, for example, a chuttamatram, because a chuttamatram would hold that a vase, which is a functioning thing, exists truly. So a chuttamatram accepts that a vase exists truly, a functioning thing exists truly. So they would say, do you also, middle way proponent, do you accept that this vase exists truly, or is truly existent, although it is a conventionality. So here we see from the Svatantrika, from the Gundagana. Now, so Umapa Yamuna Rangyuba.
Umapa,
so then we hear, sorry, just making sure, the middle way proponent saying that no, we do not accept conventional true existence. At all. Yeah, we don't accept true existence at all, not conventionally, not ultimately. So this distinguishes a middle way proponent from a mind-only proponent. So they don't accept true existence at all. So, but the vase is still there. So the vase, just the vase, is there as a conventionality. However, a truly existent vase doesn't exist ultimately or conventionally. Yeah? So a vase, there is a vase, it's a conventionality, we can use it, it's there, but it's not truly existent as a conventionality or ultimately truly existent. So in other words, a middle way proponent doesn't accept true existence at all. So again, just look here in our definition. So we have, so they do not assert truly existent functioning things even conventionally. So then, how do conventional objects exist? And do objects exist truly, do objects exist truly in any way at all? And conventional objects themselves, how, such as the stars or any functioning thing, how do they exist? So the middle way proponents would say, so this vase that you're questioning now, this functioning thing as an illustration, this vase here, So if this were to exist truly, or be truly established or truly existent, then this vase wouldn't require a mind to impute onto the vase, so impute something onto the vase, for example, a vase. There would be no need for a mind to impute vase on vase, on this object, because from the side of the object, this truly existent object, it would be existing without the need of imputation at all. However, there is no object that doesn't require imputation. There is a requirement for a mind to impute onto the object. If the object existed truly, there would be no need for imputation. But there is always a need for imputation. So we can see this, well, we can't really see a vase, but we pretend we're seeing a vase here. So we can all see this vase, not only can we see this vase, but we can use this vase. So we can pour water from it or put flowers in it, so we can use this vase. However, just having this vase here, for us to know that it is a vase, requires mental engagement. So from the side of the object possessor, from the side of the person seeing the vase, there is some process of imputation. If that wasn't required, then there is no requirement for mind to label vase to know that there's a vase, then this vase, and everyone yet knew it was a vase, then it would be a truly existent vase, because there isn't a requirement for mental engagement or for mental labeling. However, for every object, in this case the vase, there is a requirement for the mind to label, the mind to identify this as a vase. And so there's this mental process. And because there's this mental process, then this object cannot be truly existent. If this object were truly existent, it wouldn't depend on a labeling process at all. So if it, and just to say lastly, if the object didn't exist, if the object existed truly and therefore didn't require any labeling at all, wherever one took this vase, everyone would just know it was a vase without ever at some point learning that that was a vase, without any mental, and therefore any mental engagement, labeling vase and the like. Because everyone would know just from the side of the object, that's a vase without any involvement of mind.
Yeah,
Yani zaten bir ya benim ha öyle şey o dilde soğuk tarafı konuşuyor böyle. Ya biz kocaman o konu dili diye lain var. Sürbari, sürbari elbiseler. Sürbari ya min üyesi yok. Min par. Sürbari seri var.
Le par?
Le par. Şerli o sürbari yok. Ne diye sürbari yok. Ama o ne diye lain var. Ne diye bir dilde soğuk tarafı konuşuyor sadece. En cemal bir türlü ne diye sürbari. Cenab sürbari. Peki ne diye hindi kapakı sürbari yok.
So to take another illustration, other than our vase, let's take a member of parliament. So a member of parliament, if we happen to either see them on a poster or see them in the street, we'll immediately know, oh, that's a member of parliament. However, when she was born, then when her mother saw her, she didn't think, wow, oh, I've just given birth to a member of parliament. Rather, this would be her daughter. And later she would grow up, she would stand for elected office, she'd have to win an election. Having won the election, then people knowing she has won an election would say, that is a member of parliament. How does that process work? You have the object, and then you have this mind imputing, now for the first time, member of parliament onto that object. Every time someone sees her, knowing that she's now a member of parliament, then they would automatically just know, ah, there's a member of parliament. But this is dependent on a mind being involved, and certainly initially saying, oh, she's won her election, she's now an MP. And likewise, at some point, she will either not stand for re-election, or she'll lose an election, and then no one will see and say, oh, there's our member of parliament. Rather, there's our former member of parliament. She's now an ex-MP. So again, this new status comes about independence on mental engagement. Independence on a new label being applied to her. So no longer is she labeled as a member of parliament, but now as an ex-MP. So this shows how the mind engages with the object. If this wasn't required, and if whoever met her from whatever time in her life immediately knew member of parliament, then she would be a truly existent member of parliament. But that wasn't or isn't the case. Labeling was required from each side. Therefore, she's not truly existent. So similarly to that example, all phenomena, whether permanent or impermanent, require to be labeled by mind. They require this mental engagement from the side of the mind, labeling the object. Whether the object is permanent or impermanent, a functioning thing or a permanent phenomenon, doesn't matter. It requires this labeling process. If it didn't require mental engagement, if there was no need for mental labeling, then that object would be truly existent. However, if there is this requirement for the mind to label, therefore, there are no truly existent objects. Now, we've spoken now a little bit about the object, and we've spoken about the mind and the need, the requirement for the mind to be engaged with the object. But now let's look at how the object appears to our awareness, how the object appears to our mind. So the mind, the object, appears to us as if it doesn't require mental engagement. It doesn't require this labeling process. So in other words, the object appears to be truly existent. The object appears to be truly existent or truly established. Why? Because it appears as if it doesn't require mental engagement. So we're still looking at the definition of the proponent of non-nature, or someone who's a proponent of the middle way, Madhyamika. So all of them, so whether they divide it into Svatantrika or Prasangika, so autonomous or consequentialist, they all will say that an object requires to be, an object or phenomenon needs to be labeled by mind. There's a requirement for mental engagement. If an object didn't require mental engagement for it to be known, then that would be a truly existent phenomenon. However, there is no truly existent phenomena. So both Prasangika and Svatantrika do not accept truly existent phenomena. And what is a truly existent phenomenon? It's an object that doesn't require mental engagement. Proponents of the middle way, they assert that the object of abandonment is what we're talking about here, this true existence or true establishment. That is the object of abandonment. And so why are we looking at this? Why is it so important? And this is the main thing we've been talking about tonight, is when the yogi comes to investigate what the I is, the yogi will sit in meditative contemplation and look how the I appears. And investigate, you try and see how the I appears to the yogi's mind. And then when the I appears in a way that's clear and the yogi can see, ah, this is how the I appears to exist, then the yogi investigates that I. So this I see how now it's appearing to me. This I, where is it to be found? And the yogi will invest their form and invest their body, and to see where in my body is the I to be found. And then the I, if it's not found in the body, then the consciousness will be the other place that one would look. So which mind could be the I? Which moment of that mind could be the I? And the yogi will investigate like this, looking for the I. So this is the investigation of emptiness. And this is the purpose of why we're talking here about true existence, because true existence is the object of negation. And sorry, it's before the object of abandonment, the object of negation. And so here the yogi will investigate this to come to understand emptiness. When it comes to what emptiness is, we'll have some kind of rough understanding. We will all sit here and acknowledge that the eye is not my arm, it's not my leg, it's not my head. So this kind of coarse understanding of what the eye isn't, this is an emptiness, of course. We all know this coarsely, but we need to go somewhat more subtly than that. First thing we need to come to understand, or the first thing that we need to see clearly, is how the eye appears to our mind. So this is something that we need to see clearly, and only once we see that clearly, so how the eye appears to the mind, can we then investigate. So that's really a crucial step, is how the eye appears to the mind. And once that happens, once we come to see the object of negation, we can then start to investigate it. And our investigation will, of course, start in a quite a rough or coarse manner, and as we progress, we'll be able to investigate how the eye appears in a more subtle and more refined manner. Now, as one progresses, then it's very possible that a feeling of fear can arise. And why? Because as one is searching for the eye in a more refined and a further refined manner, the eye is still not being found. And then one, of course, can get this feeling of fear of, I do not exist. The eye doesn't exist. I do not exist. So this is very possible.
Tongue,
通过去，感觉到啊，通过那个气场，然后去发。 fine to step over out of the way. And then it is, and the whole
So continuing with this meditation on emptiness, so the yogi would be looking in a more and more refined manner for this I. Where is it? How does it exist in this way that it appears? And we'll start to come to this realization of this understanding of emptiness. And as this understanding of emptiness grows, then this conviction will be that the conviction that the way the I appears is not how it exists, that conviction will grow stronger and there'll be more confidence that the way that I'm seeing this I, I'm not finding it. So therefore this way that this I appears is not how it exists. However, the I still exists. So then how does it exist? Then the yogi starts to investigate, so this I that it doesn't exist in the way that it appears, how does it exist? So here, we come to this term, imputation. So the I exists merely imputed on the aggregates. How does I exist again? Merely imputed on the aggregates. If the I wasn't imputed on the aggregates, if there was just no need for this imputation, it would be truly existent. Because this is what we're hearing, something that is not imputed by mind and would be truly existent. This isn't accepted. So rather, the I is imputed onto the aggregates, and this means it is a dependent arising. The I exists independent on imputation. So therefore, the I is a dependent arising. And this, if we think back to what we studied in the Heart Sutra now some months ago, there we had a lot of these negative words or negating words, not this or no, no, no. And so this was to show how one thing is dependent on the other. It's not, nothing is truly existent. So we saw this in the Heart Sutra. We spoke then a lot about dependent arising, how one thing is dependent on something else, and that nothing is truly existent. So here we see the way that the I exists is not how it the way the I exists is not how it appears. How does it exist? Not as a truly existent thing, because there is this requirement for labeling onto the aggregate. And so the I, being a functioning thing, we see doesn't exist truly. And that then comes back to our definition here as do not assert truly existent functioning things, even conventionally. Hence the emphasis on functioning things. What we're talking about here, this thinking about emptiness or meditating on emptiness, this is the most important thing. Investigating emptiness, investigating the I, this is the main thing. So why? Why is it so important? So we first need to come to see how the I appears. So it appears to us to be truly existent, no requirement for imputation. So it appears to us to be truly existent, and we believe that it exists in this way, that the I exists truly. This mind that believes that the object, in this case I, exists truly, is the mind of true grasping. Grasping at the object as being truly existent, true grasping. This mind of true grasping is the root of all our afflictions. So that is the mind we need to, of course, abandon, this root of all our afflictions. Hence, this meditation is so important. So when you investigate how the eye appears, and you'll see that it appears to be truly existent. And this, it's not just that it appears to be truly existent, we believe this. So this believing, this, which is a mind of course, this mind that believes that the way that the eye appears is how it exists, this is the mind of true grasping. So the mind that grasps at the eye as existing in the way it appears, as existing truly. This, as we've seen, is the root of all our afflictions, the cause of all our afflictions. So every negative mind that we have, whether it's attachment or jealousy or anger, all of these come from this true grasping. And of course, we don't just have these minds ripening in our continuum and leave it at that. We act under these minds. We engage in activities due to attachment. We say things due to, out of anger and the like. So we accumulate this negativity through our three doors because of this, you know, the presence of afflictions in our mind, which arise due to self-grasping. That's a root. So, we know what happens as a result from this negativity that we engage in. We accrue negative karma, it's eventually ripens in rebirth, and again ripens in lower realm rebirth. So this all comes from this stream of a lower realm that leads eventually ending in lower realm rebirth, comes from the presence of the self-grasping mind, which is believing that the I exists truly. And then, furthermore, this karma that we are accumulating in this way, this is, as we were hearing this week in the Lamrim teachings, is contaminated karma. And this contaminated karma leads to the arrival of contaminated aggregates. And contaminated aggregates are, of course, in the nature of suffering. And what type of suffering? The all-pervasive suffering of conditioning. So this we did, previous week in the Lamrim, so 10 days ago. And we saw then how it's through this true grasping that leads to all the afflictions and the accumulation of negative karma, and that leads to the perpetuation of samsara, that we have this all-pervasive suffering of conditioning, which is manifested in these aggregates. And having these aggregates, which are pervaded by suffering, we of course experience the suffering of change. And if we're experiencing the suffering of change, we then experience the suffering of suffering. So all of this we can trace back to the way that we grasp at the I, grasping at it as being truly existent. So when we were looking at the Lamrim, we also spoke about the method to abandon this problem that we find ourselves in. And that's exactly what we've been talking about now in some detail. It's contemplating emptiness. It's developing this wisdom realizing emptiness. Because it's through that we come to cut this root of affliction. We come to be able to develop the actual antidote and or the direct antidote to this the object of abandonment is this mind of true grasping. So this, just then to encapsulate it again, so this the contaminated karma and afflictions that we accumulate and that leads to all these types of suffering, these come about because we do not realize that this I is a dependent arising. So it's dependent on imputation. Rather, we see it as being truly existent. However, by coming to realize that the I is a dependent arising, it's not truly existent, then we'll come to abandon this self-grasping mind, which is the cause or the root of all our other afflictions. And this way, we'll cut the cause of the afflictions, so the afflictions will no longer ripen, and therefore, if they're not ripening in our continuum, we'll no longer be acting under their influence, we'll no longer be accumulating contaminated karma. And that's how we break the cycle. How do we abandon this mind that grasps, this mind of true grasping, this mind that grasps as the I as being truly existent, this mind that sees how the mind that grasps at the I as existing in the way it appears, as existing truly. So how do we come to abandon that? So we abandon this mind of true grasping by investigating it in some detail. So we saw earlier that the first step was to really actually see how the I appears to us, and then investigate this mind that grasps at the I as existing truly. When we come to see that the way the I appears is not how it exists, and we start to cultivate that mind, it will of course start off being quite weak because we're just starting to get some understanding. And as this strengthens, this understanding strengthens, then the power of that mind, of course, now is stronger because we're understanding, this is how the I appears, but it cannot exist in this way, it doesn't exist in this way. So we see, on one hand, this wisdom mind is slowly starting to grow. And as the wisdom mind grows, its contrary mind, this mind of ignorance, will weaken. It's kind of like fire and, or the sun and ice. If as the sun it gets stronger on a lovely sunny day, maybe on the mountains, the ice will of course melt. These two don't exist together. They are contrary to each other, heat and frozen water. So likewise, as we start to strengthen this mind of wisdom that sees this I that appears to be truly existent And this mind that grasps everything so, this is mistaken. Because whilst the I appears to be independent of causes and conditions, in other words, labeling, it actually is dependent. It's a dependent arising. As we come to see this, our wisdom mind, as we see this, we become more habituated with this. In other words, our meditation is growing more powerful. Then the wisdom mind strengthens, and this afflicted mind weakens. And as this afflicted mind weakens, this mind of true grasping weakens, the cause that this afflicted mind, which is the cause of all our ripening afflictions, with this weakening, our afflictions will start to be weaker. And the negative actions that we do under the sway of these afflictions will also be weaker. And this process will continue as the wisdom mind grows stronger and stronger through our habituation. This habituation comes from hearing teachings again and again, thinking about the teachings again and again, eventually being able to meditate on emptiness. As this mind grows and grows and grows, this afflictive mind weakens and weakens and weakens until it eventually is eliminated. And in those, when it's eliminated, then the cause that gives rise to our afflictions has been eliminated. Therefore, our afflictions don't arise. And if our afflictions are not arising, we're not engaging in negative actions anymore. So we've broken the circle. And if once the circle has been broken, we're no longer taking rebirth under the sway of contaminated karma and afflictions, there is no more, we're no longer pervaded by suffering, this all conditioning suffering, this suffering of all pervasive conditioning. And if we're not pervaded by this all pervasive suffering, then we'll no longer experience the suffering of change. If we're not experiencing the suffering of change, we're not experiencing the suffering of suffering. So this means we're not experiencing suffering at all. Those three types of suffering have been cut because we cut the root. That means we are only experiencing happiness. Hopefully from this you can see why emptiness is so very important and why what we're studying here, therefore, is so very important. And thinking about emptiness, starting to think about it a bit and then more and more and more, really is essential. And I do it sometimes, but I also need to make some more effort in this. But hopefully from the explanation here, we all can now see why it is so important and therefore engage in this more and more. And I also need to do this a bit more. So yes, I know that this is important, but I don't really make enough effort with this, and this I really need to do. So let's talk a little bit now about nihilism and eternalism. So nihilism and eternalism. So first of all, let's talk about eternalism, because that is very relevant to what we're talking about here. So what is eternalism? It's if someone accepts true existence, they accept eternalism. So yeah, so someone who accepts true existence accepts eternalism. Therefore, Chittamatrans, etc., they are eternalists. They accept true existence. So they accept that things are eternal, I suppose. So the mind that accepts, so the mind that it believes in true existence is a mind that accepts eternalism. So if, therefore, if one accepts that functioning things or impermanent phenomena are truly existent, then one accepts eternalism. And this is something that middle wave proponents do not accept, but the other schools do. Then the other term, nihilism. So what is nihilism? So if those who, if someone says that something, if something is not truly existent, then it is a non-existent, they are nihilists. So if something is not truly existent, then it has to be non-existent. Such a person is a nihilist. So they would hear this explanation and say, so therefore, karma, it's not truly existent, because we've heard that everything is not truly existent. So therefore, karma is a non-existent. This person, a person who thinks like this, is a nihilist. Or Buddhahood, it's not truly existent. Therefore, it cannot exist. It doesn't exist. Such a person is a nihilist. And amongst Buddhists who are nihilists, again, it's the non-Madhyamikas. It's the Chittamatrans, the Sautrantikas, and the Vaibhashikas. Because they all assert true existence. And so now if they say, if they then believe that if something is not truly existent, therefore cannot exist, therefore they are nihilists. So the Madhyamikas would say that the non-Madhyamikas are both eternalists and nihilists. With this explanation of eternalism and nihilism in mind, we can see that someone who propounds the tenets of the middle way schools, they will not be eternalists. Why? Because they don't accept true existence. So therefore, a proponent of the middle way is not an eternalist, because a true existence is not accepted. However, they don't then say, therefore, nothing exists at all. They say functioning things, etc., permanent and impermanent phenomena, they still exist. So therefore, a proponent of the middle way, Madhyamika, is not a nihilist even. So they're not a nihilist because they say that Just because something is not truly existent doesn't mean it doesn't exist, so therefore they're not a nihilist, and they're not an eternalist because they don't accept true existence at all. Therefore, they are called proponents of the middle way. And that would be the etymology of why they're called the middle way school, because they follow the middle path, not going to the extreme of nihilism or eternalism. Proponents of the middle way, so both the Svatantikas and the Prasangikas, they will say, we are proponents of the middle way, we don't go to either of those extremes. And we also like to say this about ourselves. We say, oh, we agree with the middle way view. And then these proponents of the middle way, actual proponents, so they will point to the Chittamashams and the Svatantikas and the Vaibhashikas and say, no, sorry, you're not on the middle way path, you've gone off to the extreme. It's us, we are the proponents of the middle way. The Chittamashams, they're not likely to sit here and accept that they are extremists, because who's going to accept the view that you're off to the extreme and not in the middle way? They would say, no, we are proponents of the middle way. You people who call yourself proponents of the middle way, you are extremists. We're the ones on the correct path. Of course, they're going to think like this, otherwise they wouldn't choose, they wouldn't accept their tenets. So they point to the Madhyamikas and say, you are nihilist. Why? Because you do not accept true existence. Therefore, you are nihilist. Your view is wrong. And so here we have the Madhyamikas saying to the Chittamashams, you're extremist. And you have the Chittamashams saying back, no, you are extremist. And actually, if in this conversation there were Svatantikas and Vaibhashikas, they would be saying the same thing. You guys have got it wrong. We're the only proponents of the middle way, the only ones who are steering a path between the two extremes. So everyone tends to think this about themselves. So if we think about this in our life, we actually probably like this in very many ways. We think our views are correct, hence we have them. We think our country is great. And we tend to think that our way of thinking is the correct way, the best way. We tend to point the finger of criticism elsewhere. Our country is great, that country really not so good. Or the way I'm doing things, this is good. Are these people, how are they doing it? No, they should rather be doing it like I'm doing. This is something that comes to mind rather a lot for us. Mm-hmm. So whilst proponents of all Buddhist schools will hold that they are on the correct path, they are not going to either extreme, so therefore they could be called proponents of the middle way. When we hear this term, it doesn't refer to any school other than the middle way school, the school that is divided into the Prasangika and Svatantika. So whilst other tenet holders may call their view in accordance with the middle way, their understanding would be different. And so this term middle way only refers to the Prasangika and Svatantika school, the middle way. So please do keep this in mind when you read text, that whenever you come across the middle way, it's referring to the mother school of the Prasangika and the Svatantika. It's not referring to any other school, even though they of course don't see themselves as extremists. And that they are called proponents of the middle way isn't because to put them up and put others down. They just have this name and for this reason. So that's the first outline. Then the second outline, there are two divisions, autonomous and consequentialist. And then the third outline gets divided into the two schools, so a detailed presentation on the Svatantika and the Prasangika.
Yeah. just did it on this camera, didn't understand anything to work on that. And then, you see what you did, share it here in the world. You see, that's me, you know, get. And then, you want to get it. I'm the chief, Jerry. That's it, you look on Jerry, get it. So, now, you don't get it. Yeah. This is that, you see, Jerry, you know, so long, Jerry, you go, Tim, what's not, Tim, with it. And then, so long, Jerry, Tim, what's not, Tim, with it. Many must have one star, very little. And then, German comes to school, mother, Roman, Vicky, woman, who made a man for him, but dinner, she said. What was he not doing?
Tonight we really haven't covered any words. It's just really the definition and a little bit. However, the meaning of what we covered is really quite profound. So the very few words were expressed by the author here, but there's really quite some meaning behind this. I mean, why do we look at all of this tonight? So this is important to always bear in mind. All of us here, we want to experience only happiness. We have no wish to experience suffering, no matter how small. We're all the same like that. The reason why this presentation is so important is because this presentation shows us how suffering comes about. This unwanted suffering that we all experience again and again. This presentation here tonight has shown us how this comes about. For example, we have this body. This body experiences illnesses and the like, and we suffer. We have fear and the like because of the conditions of our body, etc. Where does this come from, this illness we have? This comes from karma, contaminated karma we've accumulated. Where did that come from? How did that contaminated karma come to be accumulated? This came from us engaging in activities under the sway of afflicted minds. And so therefore, the suffering experience we have, each and every single suffering experience that we have, comes about independent on the contaminated karma that we have accumulated under the sway of afflictions. Where has this come about from? True grasping. And what was true grasping? This I appearing to be truly existent, not dependent on imputation. That mind and that grasp that appearance of the I, that true grasping is the cause of this whole process. How to abandon it? So this is again what we spoke about tonight, and we spoke about a lot. This I that appears to be truly existent, when you investigate this appearance, first when you see this appearance and we investigate it, and we see that the way that it appears, this true appearance, is not how it exists. It is a dependent arising. It appears as if it doesn't require imputation. In other words, it's independent. Rather, it is dependent on imputation. And as we cultivate this again and again and again, this mind of wisdom will start to grow stronger. And as this mind of wisdom starts to grow stronger, and the afflicted mind, this true grasping, will grow weaker. So therefore, as we make more and more and more effort in developing this understanding of emptiness, our true mind of true grasping, this quarter of all our suffering, this starting point in this chain, this mind will weaken, therefore its resulting afflictions will be weaker, and therefore the actions that we engage in under the sway of those afflictions will be weaker. And this process will continue as the wisdom mind strengthens, the afflicted mind and all its resulting afflicted minds will weaken, until eventually we get to the stage of eliminating it. However, for this meditation, this very profound meditation on emptiness, for it to go well, it requires this power of merit behind it. So therefore, we need to engage also in the accumulation of merit, not just the accumulation of wisdom. So previously, we've mentioned this repeatedly, we need to, as well as engage in the meditation of emptiness, engage in acts of generosity, ethical conduct, patience, with the power of joyous perseverance. And then tonight, whilst we didn't speak about those so much, we certainly spoke about the wisdom and concentration that is required for wisdom to be effective. So these are the six acts coming together here. So tonight we spoke mainly about the wisdom that requires the concentration, but we also need to engage in the other acts, because they serve to power the meditation. And if we continue like this, these parts which really may seem quite distant, the parts of accumulation and then preparation, will start to become closer and more, and actually obtainable and more realistic. Because now they may seem very far off and distant for us, but as we make progress in our meditation and we can see the way we engage in the world is different, and we can see the minds that that naturally arise for us are now changing, then we'll have the confidence of actually these parts that seem so unobtainable now and maybe just something we learn about in theory, actually these are something we can achieve, and we can achieve in this very life. So this kind of, this cultivation I've described here, this is something we all need to do. I can't sit here and say who is most experienced already in this class. It can be any one of us. But for sure, all of us, we need to cultivate these minds that we've been speaking about tonight. What we've been speaking about here in the subject of tenets is no different from what we studied a while ago in the Heart Sutra, or we're studying in the Lam Room. These all have the same meaning. The emphasis and expression changes, but the meaning is all the same. It all keeps coming back to the same thing. We need to cultivate the wisdom realizing emptiness, to cut the roots of suffering, and to do this we need to have the power of the accumulation of merit. So in all these subjects we've been studying together, this has been said repeatedly, and that's because they all come from the same Buddha Dharma. So that's what we looked at tonight. Tomorrow we'll continue. We'll start with the presentation on Satvantika and their various subdivisions. So that will be tomorrow. So some questions on tonight? Yeah, so.
I've always understood that the middle way is the middle way between eternalistic analysis and philosophies.
Mm-hmm.
But the example of eternalistic thought was not a philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
But by saying, if somebody, an eternalist, would say, if something doesn't exist truly, then it must be non-existent at all. That's a study by an eternalistic philosopher.
Mm-hmm. If he gave an example of the nihilistic philosophy, so then he said that the lowest three tenets are nihilists.
They're nihilists?
Yeah.
But they're eternals.
They're both. They're nihilists because they're saying, if you don't accept something exists truly.
Yeah, yeah. But so they have the observed consequence of their point of view.
Yeah. Okay. So, what do you want me to ask?
The middle way is not a philosophy,
yeah,
which is neither an eternalistic philosophy nor a nihilistic philosophy.
It's not a philosophy that is neither eternalistic nor...
Yeah. It's only rejecting the eternalistic philosophy.
Okay.
There is no specific nihilistic philosophy which is...
Okay, so can I ask that? So
yeah.
The middle way philosophy, the way I understand it, it's only the way I'm hearing tonight, it's only refuting the view of eternalism. It's not refuting the view of nihilism.
Well,
the way I'm hearing it tonight.
No, no.
Okay.
It's only refuting the lower schools,
yes,
which are all eternalistic. But how can they be both nihilistic and eternalistic philosophy?
Okay. I'll ask that, yeah? Yeah. then again, getting remember Sunya Deng at Sapo Kona, then the okay, Jedamar Jedamar to Depa Sensampa Sunka, Gonzo Takche Paratan, Takche Paratan di Dokso. Takche Paratan Chepepa. Gonzo Nikare Umapa Umape Latiare. Die kanntest du. Gonzo Takche Pare, jene Gonzo kanntest Yang, Chepetate, Kelin Chekerebe. So they are eternalists because they say functioning things are truly existent. And then further to this, they say if they are not truly existent, they have to be non-existent. Therefore, they are said to be nihilists. They're said to be nihilists by the middle way, because they would say that, yeah, that's exactly what I just said. So because they say if something is not truly existent, it is non-existent. Therefore, they are nihilists. But so that was what I said earlier and now. Yeah. So you're saying, but that doesn't sound like a philosophy of nihilism. No. It just sounds like a consequence. Then again, can I get just a dene? Here some of the chupta sum de, conso chetawa mare, carensana, conso taktawa de, then a taktawa yina, then a di thank you chikure, thank you re. Then a thank you kari yare, then a conso karine tempa majopa, then a de me pare, de me pare. Yine di konso di konso samsu mare konso tempo jo pa kelen che diare yine konso
tempo ma jo pa khali ge diare ki chine ka mo ko tempo jo ba ye ne lo ba ta ni ju ki ta u ma ko ko tempo jo ma re la ani cho ra mo ko tempo jo ye la lo o ko tempo ma jo na ta chi ge ye la na ko ni ta na ko ka le
di di ti tama
mo ko tempo ma jo na ani yo ba re ne ba cha ge ne yo ba chi ne ba cha ge ne sen te ka le
So the middle way proponents will say to Tamatran, so if something is not truly existent, what is it? Is it an existence or non-existent? They say it's a non-existent. Therefore, they are said to be nihilists by the middle way proponents.
That thought is nihilist,
mm-hmm.
but they believe in truth, because they're
eternal. Then Samsu De Chetawade. Yine konso takta pare, kuzen konso tempo jo pare.
Konso takta wa nagiri te, konso takta wa eba de nagiri te. Yine konso tenju suma duki pa sam sam, ishi yon su, konso takta wa rezi yore, konso tempo jo ki rindi yore. Takta wa rezi yore, cheta wa chabu kore, ane chabu yore suna, tempo jo maru na mbe dugu le
goro. Dene dene yore di tenju yore.
Tenju yore, tenju uma bi le goro.
Thank you for saying that. Thank you.
Thank you for saying that. 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 Thank you for saying that.
Thank you Die Sabhaktung, der kann man das in Santalasio bei Konso nach Taktau Yin Sangyum bei
der
So, again, as largely as was said before, so they accept your existence, therefore, the Prasangi, the middle way school said to you, you are eternalist. They don't accept they're eternalist, but this is something that is said to them because they accept your existence. Then when they are asked, So what about something that isn't truly existent? What is that? Then the Chittamarjuna will say, that's a non-existent. So then the proponents will say to them, oh, now you're also a nihilist. So both of these terms, nihilism and eternalism, are things that the Chittamarjuns will not accept about themselves. But both of these terms are thrown at them by the middle way proponents. Oh, you're an eternalist because you accept your existence. And something that isn't truly existent, you say is a non-existent, therefore you are a nihilist. The Chittamarjuns won't accept those labels, but this is what is said to them by the proponents of the middle way.
So the Dharma seekers say the middle way, they refute eternalism and nihilism. What is the nihilistic thought that they are refuting?
Sure. What is the nihilistic thought that a Vaibhashika is refuting? Jedama Lukne, Konso Chekawa Kari Kagirebe. So the understanding of what eternalism and nihilism is varies from school to school. So here what we're hearing is the understanding of the middle way school, and therefore how they would relate to the other schools. But the other schools have a different understanding of what nihilism and eternalism is. Okay, so they would say, middle way proponents, you Madhyamikas, you are nihilists. Why? Because you do not accept the things of So this is now between Vaibhashika and Prasangika. So the Vaibhashika would say to the Prasangika, you are a nihilist because you do not accept inherent existence. You don't accept existence from its by its own nature. You don't accept true existence. Therefore, you are a nihilist. Because what they propound, because the Vaibhashika say that all functioning things, so they say that all functioning things, for example, all functioning things are truly established. You're not accepting this. You I call extremists. So like that. So they have a different understanding of what a nihilist is. So they would say somebody who doesn't exist, truly exist in things, is a nihilist. So they seem to call each other this. A Chittamarjun would say someone who accepts that things are externally established is an eternalist. And the Sutta Martins would also say, if you don't accept truly that things are truly existent, then you accept nihilism, because if something isn't truly existent, for example, there would be no mind, there would be no object. So therefore you're not accepting anything, therefore you're a nihilist. So they have this different understanding of the meaning of the term.
Yeah, I think my mistake was that I thought that I didn't realize this was a debate within Buddhist schools. I thought that in India there was a school of philosophy called the nihilists.
Okay, okay.
Who were refuted. And okay. Eternalists were not. So that's what I was saying.
Yeah, that's our baptism to China. Okay. Thank you. Andy?
I was just going to get in on that one. I mean, from a worldly, non-proclaiming point of view, nihilist is somebody who believes nothing exists.
Mm.
But so these schools are saying, you just check that out, right, these schools are saying that actually, not only in the future, that, but they actually say that nobody can have that view because
So just to check, no, all Buddhist schools refute nihilism, their understanding of nihilism.
No, they refute the worldly
view
of nihilism, which is just simply nothing exists.
Okay. 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 So all Buddhist schools refute the worldly view of nihilism that nothing exists. Or do all Buddhist schools refute the worldly view of nihilism, which is that nothing exists? And do, is that the question? Do they think anyone thinks like that? Okay. Then, namgyun kai jigden pa konso cheta wasena then chama metare chikyan yopare di so jigden pa ki samsure then di jupta shi di nangpe jupta shi konso chena as konso samsure de mi chikyan samsure de Yorepe, Yomarepe, something to do.
You are a man. もうこれ電話もらったんだ。ちゃんとかもよ、まれだわ。で、さ、言うのは、で、何ちゅう、電話はまれ。さ、言うのは、よ、まれ、さ、言うのは、そうやわ。さ、言うのは、よ、まれ。で、言うのは、よ、まれ。で、からだよ、まれ。で、ま、ちゃんと、目をちゃんと、で、全然。で、ま、どんな、で、ま、どこ、で、ま、もじこで、もこ、で、ま、もじこで、ちゃんと目をだわ。で、ま、ま、ちゃんと、なんか、なんか、
So this worldly understanding of nihilism that nothing exists, this is exactly what all the Buddhist schools accuse those who don't accept their view of. So, for example, the Chittamatins will say, you don't accept true existence, then you are a nihilist. Why? Because if you're saying functioning things that aren't truly existent, then they can't exist. So what? Let's take some illustrations of functioning things. You're saying mind doesn't exist, because that is a functioning thing. You're saying not only does a normal mind not exist, then there are valid cognizers. There are no objects. So all this comes about independence on you not accepting true existence. You nihilist you. And therefore you don't accept the law of causality, you don't accept Buddhahood, you don't accept suffering, you don't even accept the food you're eating, that the food you're eating exists. So That is the understanding of nihilism. People who are accused of accepting nihilism or being nihilists are believed to just not accept that things exist in some way. So.
In the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra, it sort of seems to be nihilistic because it says no thought, no mind, no enlightenment, no. And that sort of contradicts a little bit of the concept of Fiddle Ray that you've spoken about tonight, which says that things don't truly exist because you have to conceptualize.
Mm-hmm.
That's accepting the mind, which conceptualizes.
Mm-hmm.
You understand what I'm saying? So I'm a little bit confused.
Can I ask
by the Perfection of Wisdom, because it seems to be contradicting thought.
Yes.
That thought exists.
Yes. So can I ask, how does this explanation tonight sit with the Heart Sutra? How does it sit with the Perfection of Wisdom?
Yes.
Because in the Heart Sutra, there's
not quite.
Yes.
I'm a bit confused about it. I really like these teachings tonight because it seems I could really understand emptiness at that level. That essentially of true existence, but because you have to conceptualize it for it to exist.
So I understand.
Like
so let me ask.
The ego, the I, is something that you conceptualize, so it doesn't truly exist.
Okay.
So that all really feels good to me, but
maybe I'll ask
Enda
now,
yeah?
Okay, no, I understand clearly. It's a good question, and it's something that will be covered. So it's a good question. No, it's a good question. Then again, Kenengi Selse Dogunpe Apurunari Kapo, yeah? Maybe Oshaka Zum. You need Selse D, and set up Nimbo. Gelderen is some you do. Because in Sherep Nimpo Nangala Gacha Mambo Yere. The pen go mindu, same mindu, satang mindu. The ning is some la the drama carry yere, if you think Gelder yen at the cancer.
Yeah.
So in the Heart Sutra, so there are all these negative words, no, etc. Yeah, all these negatives. So what it's not saying there is no body. Of course, if it says there's no body, well, that would be surprising. But what it's saying is there's no body or no sound, etc. that is independent. So whatever form, sound, etc. is dependent on imputation. There is no form that is not independent on imputation. So what's in the Heart Sutra is said in an abbreviated manner. But the understanding or the meaning is that there is no, for example, form, there is no form that is not dependent on imputation or dependent on mind. So that would be the meaning. So therefore the explanation tonight then sits with that. There's no form that is truly existent. There is no sound that is truly existent. But the Heart Sutra is quite abbreviated, hence those words are not there. Before all these no's come in the Heart Sutra, it's once mentioned there is no inherent existence, and that then there's no inherent existence is what one needs to do. That understanding needs to be applied elsewhere. So where elsewhere, which is no, then that is an abbreviation, and the understanding is no inherently existent body, etc. Okay, thank you.